Jeff Apter, welcome very much to the Last Post podcast interview. And you've done some great books over the times, and you've followed some interesting people. Your latest one, Jeff, is about George Young, of course, famous for the Easy Beats and Flash in the Pan and a lot of things, entitled Friday on My Mind. What drove you to write this book?
It's sort of the third accidental part of a trilogy that was never intended to be written, to be honest. Mm. A few years ago, I was very interested in writing about George's brother, Malcolm, from AC/DC. And at the time, my publisher said, oh, no, let's do a book on Angus Young. So, you know, and in the publishing world, if a publisher says, I want you to do a book, you typically say yes, because it's hard to get the work. So I thought, great. And as I'm doing that book, which was followed up by a book on Malcolm, all the while I was thinking, well, their story is really interesting. You know, the evolution of AC/DC from, you know, pretty much the Villawood hostel here in Sydney all the way to the top of the rock and roll pile. Mm. The real story, the real mentor and driving force and key player in all that was Big Brother George, because he'd been through a similar experience with the Easy Beats, which, unlike AC/DC, was a very brief moment in time back in 1966 when they had a worldwide hit with Friday on My Mind. Spent the best part of the next 3 or 4 years trying to come up with this something to match, you know, a song that's since been declared the greatest Australian song of all time, you know. And George took all that experience that he had with the Easy Beats, both good and bad, and put it into AC/DC as both a producer and a mentor to his brothers. And so I was writing these two books ostensibly about AC/DC, all the while thinking the biggest story is George, you know, because his musical career spans 35, 40 years across a number of different formats. I mean, he worked with everyone from Rose Tattoo to John Paul Young, you know, and that's a pretty broad span musically, as well as producing so many of his own great songs with the Easy Beats and with Flash in the Pan. So I was sort of gradually, almost not intentionally, but it just worked out that way, gradually working my way towards this story. I think I'm going to call it the accidental trilogy.
I think one of the outstanding things is you've just mentioned AC/DC, and like the book, it delves in across so many music genres and so much time and everything from decade to decade. We look at AC/DC, and as question, was that George Young's revenge? Because, of course, we go back to the very beginning and the visit to England with the Easy Beats. They didn't quite get a handle on that, but he was determined to do the right thing with Aka Daka, as they say.
Yeah, with his brothers. Yeah, it's true. And like I say, he really took all those experiences and all those mishaps too. You know, there was a lot went wrong for the Easy Beats. They tried too hard to be too different. And, you know, when it came to AC/DC, the best bit of advice George gave his brothers was, you were really lucky. Early on, you found your sound, so stick with it, which, let's face it, AC/DC have essentially made the same record about 15 times now.
That's right, yeah, we used to joke about that when we were younger,
It's true. They, you know, it's their sound and they do it really, really well. And that was working on advice from George, because there were points where Malcolm and Angus said, you know, should we try something different? Should we try to mix it up? And he said, why? You're so good at what you do. Stick with it. So, yeah, I wish that quote was mine, George Young's Revenge. It's actually a writer called Clinton Walker who wrote a great book on Bon Scott. And it's true. It's true. I think everything that George strived for and missed out with the Easy Beats, and all the experience that he gained from those 5 years, really, you know, in the spotlight internationally, he put into AC/DC. He was his brother's advisor, mentor, and record producer, you know. So, yeah, in a lot of ways, I guess he claimed probably some of the greatest satisfaction of his entire career was watching how successful AC/DC became.
Yeah, indeed, Jeff, indeed. And of course, I guess he identified his brothers as not being particularly skillful songwriters, but of course that honed with the emergence of the sound of Aka Daka. And I guess if we go back to the very beginning, the book is an amazing chronological look at George's life from the very beginnings, you know, when they came out from Glasgow. He was about 16 or something, I think.
He was just a kid, absolutely, yeah. And in fact, as I learned during the writing of the book, it was George and one of his older brothers were the big motivators to come out to Australia, which was interesting. I thought, you know, typically it's post-war parents, the opportunity comes up to be £10 Poms or £10 Scots in the case of the Youngs, and it's the parents that really dictate it, but not in this case. George, I guess he saw something in Australia, and it proved to be right, because as soon as they got to Villawood, that's where he met Harry Vander, and that's where he met the other members of the Easy Beats, and it all came together really quickly. It was within, I think, 18 months of arriving in Australia. And
it all happened so quickly, Jeff, that's right.
It did. He was suddenly at the front of, you know, the biggest band in Australia, Australia's own Beatles. You know, it must have been an incredibly heady journey for him those first couple of years in Australia. Imagine that, you know, Villawood is starting from scratch. You know, you're in the migrant hostel and you know that you've got a long way to go, but somehow George transformed it so quickly through good luck. You know, Harry Vander happened to be there, as did the other guys from the band.
Yep.
And just a good musical breeding. His sister, Margaret, was a big influence on him, his older sister.
That's right,
back in, you know, back in Scotland, she'd... she seemed to have a way of finding new records. You know, she had her hands on all the records coming across from America at the time and introducing George and his other brothers to that. His older brother, Alex, who was a career musician as well, he was a big influence on him. And he stayed in England and ended up in spending a lot of time in Germany working there in a lot of the clubs that the Beatles worked in, you know, the Star Club in Hamburg and all these places. So George had a good musical pedigree. You know, he was surrounded by people who really were either great music fans or really good musicians. And that all exploded with the Easy Beats. You know, it seemed almost natural for George in some ways to just explode. And also they had a great mentor in Ted Albert, who was...
Ted was amazing, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, again, you know, it was the perfect timing. Ted was the latest head of the company that had been around since the early 20th century, selling sheet music and, you know, the Boomerang
Albert
harmonica.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, and a real family dynasty, you know, a very wealthy and very well-heeled Sydney family. And Ted in the 60s, as he saw what was happening with the Beatles, realised that, you know, selling sheet music was one thing, but recording and developing your own artists, that was the way of the future. And then he, by chance, got introduced to the Easy Beats, and he really helped make that, what they called an easy fever, happen very quickly by as their producer. So, yeah, it was a series of fortunate events, I guess, in some ways. But also, you know, George had those nascent songwriting skills, and when he got together with Harry in particular, Harry Vander, the magic happened.
Yes, it was incredible. That's right. And I guess, actually, if we just... I mean, there's so much here to discuss in this book, Jeff. It's quite incredible Friday in my mind. We look at... You spoke earlier about, over in England, them concentrating perhaps too much on wanting to be different. And maybe the seeds for that were sown when they were compared to the Beatles, I think, but someone... And then George said, oh, we want to make sure that our next song is nothing like Friday on My Mind. You know, they wanted it to be different like the Beatles, but... But in the end, they couldn't manage that, and that's when, I guess, the realisation that they weren't the Beatles or it came to being.
Yeah, that's right. You know, George, they went through a lot of evolutions in an attempt to be themselves. You know, they, if you listen to their back catalogue is amazing. You know, there's some incredible stuff there. It's the psychedelic songs, the songs that are influenced by ska and reggae. There's, you know, out-and-out rock songs. There's big pop ballads. There's songs that could have been sung by, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck or the Walker Brothers, you know, these really grand, elegant, big productions. And as George later came to understand, the problem was there was no, to a, you know, a new audience member, there was no distinctive Easy Beat sound because there were so many different things. And later in their career, you know, pretty much when the wheels were coming off, they made a couple of songs. One was Good Times, which was later covered by In Excess and Jimmy Barnes.
That's right.
And the other one was St. Louis. And they were both just good, old-fashioned, four-on-the-floor rockers, and they were great songs.
Yep.
And I'm sure at that point George thought, bugger it, we should have been doing that all along.
Yeah, that's right. St. Louis was a great song. I remember that coming out. It was last year of primary school for me, and I really liked to hear the fact that the Easy Beats were still going because they'd dropped off the radar in Australia. But it was a great song. And, yeah, maybe that could have been part of... But they did eventually get back together in 86, but perhaps we'll talk about that in a minute. I guess... so Ted Albert was responsible for a lot of that stuff. And I guess in Australia at that time, Jeff, it wasn't really recognised the fact that Australian acts could write their own music.
No, yeah, you covered international artists because it was a safe bet. You know, people like JOK and Coldjoy and so on have built their careers basically on taking the latest hits from overseas and giving their own spin on them, and that was considered perfectly normal and natural, and that was the way things were done. You know, and hopefully you got your version out before the international one hit our shores, so it made it look as though you were the original artist. But yeah, we didn't have songwriters. You know, the Bee Gees were still finding their way. They were around, and in fact, there's one scene in the book which was described to me where, you know, the three Bee Gees turn up at the Villawood Hostel. Barry Gibb and George Young sit down on a mound outside a hall, start strumming guitars together. Imagine if someone had walked up to them with a crystal ball and said, "Hey, imagine, let me tell you where you're going to be in 10 years' time."
My God.
And they both shook their heads, as ambitious as they were.
That's right.
No way in the world that's going
to
happen.
When Robin and Morris were too small to reach the microphone or something,
that's right.
So Barry sang the song and then went outside later with George. That was amazing.
Can you imagine that? You know, the meeting of two of the greatest songwriters in Australia's history, as kids at the migrant hostel. It was it's a fantastic scene to me. You know, something that's begging to be made into some kind of movie or miniseries. The two of them sitting there with, you know, as I say, as ambitious as they no doubt were, with no idea what was in the future for them. It would have been incredible.
No, that's
right.
So
songwriters were few and far between in Australia at the time. That's right. And Ted Albert saw the potential for artists that wrote their own songs, because that's what the Beatles did, and that's how the Beatles changed music.
Well, they did, actually. That's right, Jeff. And I guess one of the things about the book, of course, again, with so many Australian acts, so many acts universally or globally, the Beatles figure in a pivotal moment. It was when George went to see the Beatles that he realised that he wanted a group. He didn't want a backing band. He wanted to be in a group.
Which was the fashion at the time too. You know, you would have the front man out the front in a backing band, you know, Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs, Johnny O'Keefe and whoever was backing him at the time.
Yeah.
You know, or Normie Rowe, all those bands were front men with a backing band kind of in the shadows, if you like.
Yeah.
George wanted something different because he could see. And, you know, you think about those shows. I think about the Sydney shows for the Beatles. You know, if you look at collectively who was in the crowd of those shows, it was all of the Bee Gees. It was all of the Easy Beats. It was everybody from, you know, the Malcolm and Angus from AC/DC. You know, all had that same – John English, as I've learned recently, all had that same epiphany of this one show. My God, this is totally different to what we're doing, and we can do this ourselves. These are just four working class guys from Liverpool.
I was interviewing someone the other day, and they went to the concert in Melbourne because their mother got free tickets or something. And so, yeah, once again, pivotal.
Life-changing experience, absolutely. And, yeah, George definitely came away from that with a new plan. You know, this is what we can do, as did all those other people that I mentioned. And it was, as I have written in the past about the Bee Gees, that had a similar impact on them. They thought, it's time to get rid of the daggy outfits with our initials on the, on the sleeve. Get rid of all of that and start writing our own songs and try finding our own voice. You know, it is interesting that so many people wanted to imitate the Beatles, but at the same time, the really good acts that came out of that were the ones that went, that's great, now let's try to do it, but in our own way.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because you never...
I think the Easy Beats achieved that.
Yeah, I think they did too. You can never keep up with the Beatles because they changed so dramatically right through their career, which was the beauty of it. But we talk about, I guess, suddenly, I guess, the Easy Beats made it, I guess, where were they working at the Beatle Village and then also the rival club, the Bowl or something, and there was... This is where they started to be noticed, I guess.
Yeah, and look, that era, I mean, I have mixed feelings about the many mini-series that have been made recently, you know, INXS, Olivia Newton-John, Peter Allen. But I think the Easy Beats one, which was also called Right On My Mind, really captured that beautifully. And the descriptions of those clubs that I've been given by people who worked with the band and were involved at the time, it's pretty accurate. You know, they were dank and dirty and dusty places, you know, and basically they were a lot like, I imagine, the Cavern would have been like in Liverpool. You find your way down a little narrow stairwell and there's a stage up the back and it smells and it's sweaty and the water's dripping from the ceiling, but there's a real atmosphere there. Mm. And if you look at those scenes in that miniseries, they really capture what it must have been like to be a young band getting a following, and really finding your own sound. It must have been the most exciting times of their lives.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. That's one series or television production I haven't seen, but I did hear that Friday in My Mind production was perhaps closer to the truth than, as you say too, Jeff, and many of the others.
And it just really captured that to me, that excitement. I mean, we can, you know, as onlookers, we can only imagine what it must be like to have been 18, 19, 20 years old and suddenly find yourself at the top of the pile. It must have been so exciting, even though George admittedly grew increasingly cynical as he got older.
Yes.
For that moment in time, to play at those clubs and develop that following, and their following included, you know, people like Olivia Newton-John and a whole bunch of interesting fledgling musicians themselves. To have that happen, just to explode in that way, must have been so exciting. There's a good photos that we found for the book of, you know, crowds, you know, the reaction of crowds to them. And just, I've got a couple of photos in there, the looks on George's face as he makes his way through screaming masses of fans.
There's great photos in the book.
Yeah, he looks slightly bewildered, I think. It's like, what happened?
Yeah, that's right. And how's that story about, getting the onion, putting it in his eyes. What song was that?
Right.
He'd turn his back to the audience.
There was a fair bit of stagecraft there, that's for sure. There was a song called In My Book, which was a bespoke piece for Stevie because he had the big female following. They'd all be down the front of the stage weeping with joy at the sight of little Stevie, who was a human dynamo on stage, you know. And it's a bit sad, the legacy of Stevie Wright, that we tend to think about him as a bit of a train wreck over the last 30 years of his life. But, you know, at his peak, there was no better front man in Australia. And he also knew how to put on a bit of theatre too. So what would happen is they'd play this big weepy song and Stevie at some point would turn his back to the audience, grab some onion skin, rub them in his eyes to bring on some tears, and turn and look as though he was embracing the song so wholeheartedly that it actually burst into tears because that only made the screams go even louder.
So,
you know, it was a lot of fun, good bit of stagecraft, and it really helped nurture that female following, which was huge for the Easy Beats. You know, Easy Fever was really the same kind of eruption of noise and excitement and, let's face it, hormones that greeted the Beatles when they toured here.
So, yeah, very similar. Yeah,
they really knew how to play it, that's for sure.
Yeah, and they had a great string of singles, of course, which originally George had written, called co-written with Stevie. But then George dropped Stevie as a songwriter. There's a couple of different versions on how that affected Stevie.
Yeah, look, my understanding is that Stevie had, as a lyricist, and that was perfect for what they, if you look at those early songs, Sorry, Wedding Ring, you know, and stuff like that, it's all good, straightforward rock and roll songs. The lyrics aren't particularly complex, but they're with what George and Harry were working on. But I guess, you know, George's ambition was a bit broader. And also, once they got to the UK, which is 1966, according to Stevie's biographer, you know, Stevie, let's say, enjoyed the lifestyle of a pop star.
Yes.
You know, I think that the quote was he was much more interested in chasing girls than smoking hash. You know, that's more power to him. He was embracing the moment. But George was a musician. He was driven, as was Harry. And Harry was limited initially, of course, as a lyricist because he spoke little English.
That's right.
You know, there's some funny moments in the book about, you know, Harry saying, I think I'm getting sunstrike.
That's right, that's right. That's right.
You know, I think he means sunstrike. He said, oh, no, it's very bad. I've got sunstrike. You know? And it took a while for his English to get to a point where George could work with him as a lyricist. But once it did, the songs grew progressively, I think, more interesting and probably reached their peak with Friday on My Mind, which is not just an Australian classic to me. It's one of the great songs of the 60s. You know, when people like David Bowie and Bruce Springsteen and so on are covering that song, you know that it has staying power and it's a really influential song for so many people.
We heard it on Pinups by Bowie.
That's right, exactly. And Springsteen covered it last time he toured here, I think in 2014.
Good version.
Yeah, and, you know, that's 50 years down the line. So for a song to have that kind of longevity, it says eons about the quality of the song. And, you know, it was both a blessing and a curse, of course, for the Easy Beats, because, as I said earlier, they then spent a lot of time trying to come up with something just as good.
It
reminds me of, there's been a bit of attention recently on Paul Hogan. has been saying, hey, I was a one-hit wonder, but it was a really good hit.
I heard that. I heard that, and I think that's brilliant.
I think in the East Beats case, if they're only remembered for that one song, it was a pretty bloody good song.
Yeah, that's right, indeed. And, of course, I think, what, Radio Luxembourg and Radio Caroline and Radio London, maybe, were part of that. Jeff, is that true?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, the BBC at that time, this is 1966, was still pretty stodgy, still very restricted in how much pop, and pop music really to them was still, you know, Cliff Richards and The Shadows and things like that. It was still very conservative.
Mm.
But all these quite forward-thinking DJs who'd set themselves up on these boats, there's a great movie called, its title's escaped me, but a
isn't it funny?
About
it's so funny.
Yeah. And that really, I think, captured the spirit of that. And a lot of those DJs who went and worked on those boats and worked with Radio Caroline and Radio Luxembourg, they were Aussies, they were expat Aussies, guys like Alan Freeman and so on. So to have a young Australian band in the UK, sure, they were going to encourage them, you know. So it really helped spread that Friday on My Mind and make it, you know, it was a top 10 hit in the UK, a top 10 hit in the US. As we just said, was covered by some pretty impressive people, but it really helped the pirate radio took to the band and that song particularly at a time when it was almost impossible to get on the BBC unless you were the Beatles. You know, it was very, very hard. So, yeah, and again, you know, like I said, when George came to Australia, when the Easy Beats came to the UK, it was a matter of really good timing, working with the right people. The producer on that was a guy called Shel Talmy, who just had hits with The Who and The Kinks. So he was a really hot producer at the time. And there's this great story about Friday on My Mind that George and Harry had this nuts and bolts of the song, but it was just missing something. And the producer said, you know, go take a couple of hours off, go and work on the song.
That's right.
And they went to a movie. They just went and slacked off for the afternoon. And the short at the start of the movie was a documentary about this a cappella group called the Swingle Sisters.
That's right.
And they inspired that that kind of staccato type singing that you hear in Friday on My Mind that really made the song. So again, just a random event.
I mean, how lucky they went to the movies to see that.
It could have been any cinema. They could have gone to the wrong place. They could have ended up sitting through some, you know, the latest Pink Panther or something. And instead, they just happened to find this moment and this singing group that inspired them. And, you know, legend has it, they went back to the studio with this idea, with this vocal idea that really became a key part of Friday on My Mind and made it the song that it is. So I guess all of music and art, there's so many of these kind of random events that lead to something fantastic. But this is our random event.
Yes, that's exactly right. And Jeff, we're talking with Jeff Apter about his magnificent book, Friday on My Mind, The Life and Times and Music of George Young from the Easy Beats. And George was, I guess at this time, struggling to find something to come up to follow Friday, but at the same time writing stuff or starting to write stuff. Was it around this time or because they wrote Step Back for Johnny Young?
That's right. That was the first song they wrote, George and Harry, that was covered by another artist. And, of course, that became a huge hit. But it really wasn't until the end of the Easy Beats that they got into becoming, you know, jobbing producers, songwriters for hire. Step Back had given them an idea that, okay, we can write for other people. And that was a huge hit in Australia. In fact, I think it was Johnny Young's first hit and probably his biggest. You know, it became his signature song. Until he started doing Young Talent Time, of course, but that's another thing altogether. But it was at that point, you know, as the Easy Beats, as they could see that it was starting, the wheels were starting to come off, that they decided our next step in our musical evolution is to become, you know, sort of jobbing writers, producers. And that led to what George later called their four-year binge, where they pretty much, the Easy Beats had ended. They did their last tour of Australia. It was early 1970. George and eventually Harry went back to the UK where they were now settled. And I believe, and though it's never really been confirmed, but probably with the backing of Ted Albert all the way, set themselves up just a little studio. And, you know, they do 5, 6, 7 songs a week. They were really prolific, writing and recording under a variety of different names. And what George intended, and I think a stroke of brilliance, he said, the biggest burden of being in a band like the Easy Beats was you had to support the entire band. So you had 5 guys had to live and breathe and, you know, get by and eat and try to produce commercial music that would keep us afloat. What we're going to do now is we won't have a band until we have a hit record, then we'll form a band. Mm-hmm. So we've done all the hard work. All the hard work's out of the way. We've got the hit record. All we have to do is then form a band. So that way we don't have to keep a band afloat. There's a stroke of brilliance to all of that.
It was, and I think we look upon George as being very business-minded in the story, and I guess perfected by the fact that then they started writing songs for Ted Mulry, for Alison McCallum, for John Paul Young, and of course there you have it. It wasn't their group; they weren't having to pay for the survival of the. It was just the songs they were writing which became the hits.
That's right, exactly. So they didn't have that burden of, you know, how are we going to keep the drummer in, toast beer? How are we going to do all these things that we need to do?
Yeah.
And, I think one of the funnier parts of that whole episode was that they would record a song, and if a record company said, yeah, we want to release it, then they'd have to suddenly form a band. And quite often they'd nip down to the local pub and just find a few blokes who look like they could pretend to be rock and roll musicians to pose for the cover photo.
Yes.
That was just genius. Oh. You know, it's like, we don't need any greening pop stars. We'll just find some blokes down the pub and they'll be the band.
Yeah, you'll do. That's fine. That's classic. Yeah.
And that also extended, I mean, they recorded one song that, and during that binge, not a lot of these songs really went anywhere. They had some smattering of, you know, success in Europe, and but it was nothing of the level of that what they'd later achieve in Australia. But, there's just moments where you just think they're just having a real laugh with this and having the best time of their lives, because there was none of the stress of, you know, coming up with that next hit. You know, instead it was just trying to get their songs to a broad market or to a broad range of people, and one of them might work. In fact, what they did at one point is Harry decided to record under the name Eddie Ivana.
Right.
And, you know, people are going, who the hell's Eddie Ivana? And they're saying, well, we'll let you know if the song's a success, because then we'll have to find someone. You know, but then the reality was, it was just Harry singing under another name.
That's right. That was incredible.
And some of it was brought on too by complications with, they still had some residual contractual problems and so on from the Easy Beats times, where, you know, they might have in the same country, they might have two recording deals, and it was a real mess. You know, when the Easy Beats ended, they were, I think, $80,000 in debt, despite all their success. So, that's all part of the George Young's revenge with AC/DC, is that he was bound not to repeat all those kind of mistakes that they'd made in the Easy Beats.
Yes,
that was definitely one of them.
I guess we're talking about George and Harry writing. It was more like copywriting for them, and it was, I guess, yeah.
Well, it was, it was probably the end of that whole, I talk about Denmark Street, which is kind of an England tin pan alley, you had music publishers and you had music writers and you had people who were all trying to hustling to make a living. And in fact, I'm reading a book at the moment, Utopia Avenue, which really looks at that period in time. It's a work of fiction, but you know it's steeped pretty heavily in music history because, you know, people like Elton John and Bernie Taupin came out of this. So I guess that's what George and Harry at that time were looking towards, you know, to be like a Bacharach David kind of combo.
Yes.
And ultimately that's what happened, you know, but they had to come back to Australia first to make that happen.
Yes, indeed. And I guess also we had I didn't even know about this, to be honest with you, and I try and keep an ear on things, but they reformed back in Australia in 86 for a tour, which started off brilliantly by all accounts at Festival Hall and then sort of just went downhill from there.
Yeah, well, I remember going to that show in Sydney. And, you know, I missed these. I was too young for the Easy Beats the first time around. And interestingly, we talked about St. Louis before, and that was my first introduction to the Easy Beats. I think I was maybe 7 years old, heard it on the radio and thought, wow, who is this? You know, what a great song. And it really became a song that, you know, 50 years later, I still think is one of the favourite songs of my youth.
Yes.
To see them in 86, it was pretty exciting. I remember being really excited. It's like, wow, it's a great Australian band. 20 years down the line, they got back together. But the reputation, unfortunately, of Stevie Wright at that point was, it was well known, you know, that he'd had a lot of toxic problems, I guess, in his life. And after the success of Evie and a few other things in the 70s, and I do remember that show that I saw seemed to be evidence of that. It was an odd encounter. I remember them really dashing through the songs very quickly.
Yes.
And, you know, just try to get the show over and done. And it was the night of George's 40th birthday, in fact. And if we look now historically, 1986, George and Harry have just spent the last 10 years back in Australia having huge success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've started to come back. They've had hits with John Paul Young. They've had hits with, as I said, Alison McCallum. They've had hits with Ted Mulry, AC/DC. The Angels are really coming along. They've mentored Rose Tattoo.
And Flash in the Pan, of course.
Flash in the Pan. Everything had really turned to gold for Harry and George. The idea of getting back into, you know, the old suits and being getting back the band back together was really not something they wanted to do. And I think I captured George's mood pretty accurately in the book, that he had really kind of ambivalent feelings about the whole exercise, but he did want to help out Stevie and Dick Diamond in particular, the bassist. He'd gone through a tough time.
Yeah, what happened with Dick? Did he end up...
Yeah, he went off the... He had some, you know, mental issues, mental health issues. He... been married briefly to this, you know, amazing-looking African-American woman who worked in musical Hair. You know, they were talking about an old couple. You know, she was this tall, striking black woman, and Dick was, you know, a Dutch Aussie from the migrant hostel in Villawood. But it didn't last long, and Dick, as I document in the book, he drifted a bit. He actually turned up at George's place in London in, I think, the early 70s, unannounced. And one of George's friends had come over from Australia with the mission to bring Dick home at his parents' request. And, you know, eventually he became a minister. He lives up in northern New South Wales now, and he's a Seventh-day Adventist minister.
Oh, wow. But I read that in the book that he was in northern New South Wales, but I did. You say he's become a minister. Incredible.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. So, you know, and so he... He'd certainly not seen much money out of the Easy Beats. Snowy Fleet, the drummer, he'd done well. He'd set himself up. He got out of music. He became a builder, and he settled down with his family in Western Australia. So he was fine. But George and Harry saw, okay, if we get the band back together, is it a chance for Stevie, who had fallen on hard times, and Dick to make some money finally out of the band? That seemed to be going pretty well until midpoint of the tour, when Stevie started to drink too much and basically fell off the rails. And I think in the end, some money was forthcoming. The plan was that everybody would walk away with a couple of $100,000 from the tour, which, you know, in 86 is pretty solid money.
But, yep.
It didn't quite happen that way. But I think in the end, Dick and Stevie, whatever money did come out of the tour, because there were cancelled shows and so on, whatever money did went to Dick and Stevie, and hopefully, certainly in Dick's case, set him up, because, you know, he's still up north now, still preaching, seems, you know, very content with that life, post-Easy Beats life, whereas Stevie, as we know, really continued to hit the skids for another 20-odd years. So, it was a tough time. I don't think George and Harry's heart were in it either.
No, I don't think so. They were businessmen primarily, I guess, particularly George.
And also in the middle of a great creative streak too. You know, they're making some great original music. So what's the point of revisiting your past?
Totally agreed.
And I would think for George, the Easy Beats brought on a fairly heavy set of mixed emotions about, you know, what might have been rather than what actually happened. So
yes.
it would have been tough for him. It's not like if the Beatles had reformed or something and the majority of their time had been golden days. Mm. It wasn't quite like that with the Easy Beats. So, yeah, and I think I captured that pretty well in the book, that it was strictly a money grab. For the benefit of a couple of people in the band, you know, it was quite a charitable gesture, if you like, on the part of Harry and George, because they were comfortable. In fact, I saw Harry's house in the eastern suburbs of Sydney the other day. It's valued at around $15 million. So,
yeah, well, wow.
He's very comfortable.
Yeah, wow, Jeff, that's incredible. And I guess their last tour, when the Easy Beats returned to Australia, I think for the last time, 69, I think, they really... It was a far, far cry from the boys that left originally. There were signs of wear and tear, and you could almost see the group breaking up in front of your eyes, but just by looking at them.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no denying that they'd indulged in the lifestyles that every rock and roll band in the late 60s indulged in, you know. And also, I think, just frustration. You know, just on George and Harry's part, they'd really tried. It's almost like they'd tried too hard, you know, to be too many things and to be this wildly eclectic and adventurous outfit, which was what we remember them as now. But at the time, it just wasn't a commercially viable thing to do. So, they looked, if you see photos of them, you'll see some, there is some video footage of them being interviewed. Admittedly, they just got off the plane, which I think, what a phenomenon at the time. You'd have these huge trans-global air flights, and the first thing you did when you got out of the plane was sit down for a press conference.
That's right. And be interviewed by Norman Gunston.
That's That's right.
That was incredible.
The last thing, or you know, either Norman or some very, very earnest, you know,
Tony Danny. Charlton.
Yeah, that's right, trying to get some kind of controversial grab from you. So, I mean, what an ordeal that must have been. All you really wanted to do was go and collapse in a hotel somewhere. And, in fact, and you're wheeled out in front of the press looking very much the worse for wear. But, you know, irrespective of that, I think you're right. I think by the time they got back here in 69, they were done physically, emotionally, and creatively too. I think, you know, the easy beats are done.
And
good. Been and gone, and George and Harry were ready for a new adventure.
Yeah, it's been a magnificent chat. Just finally, I think, Jeff, if you don't mind, if we can just touch on the strength of Harry Vander, because, of course, no one really knew that Harry was married. And then, of course, just prior to them leaving for England, his wife, Pamela, effectively committed suicide, I believe, with sleeping pills.
Yeah. Incredible, isn't it? I mean, really, the tragedy of these things, I think. You know, there was only so much money. They could only, it was really all that could be afforded was the band and their crew and management go overseas when they're going to the UK. Mm. And they were newlyweds. They're only kids, you know, they're in their early 20s. And they had a child. It's never really been proven or been revealed exactly what was the final straw, but obviously, you know, concern about the time apart, a young mother and so on. And yeah, Harry came back from a recording of what was to be a farewell show for Channel 7 and she killed herself. I mean, and in some ways, you know, and George pulled him aside and said, okay, you know, I'm going to look after you. I'm going to help you out.
That's right.
And in some ways, that was the bond that really glued George and Harry together for what the next 20-odd years of their life as a creative team. So, you know, it was a terrible moment, but it was also quite profound at the same time. You know, it could have been the end of everything.
Yep.
But, you know, Harry basically, he wanted to continue in some way, and George said to him, I'll help you through this. And, you know, that was the bond. And, you know, when you think of George, you always do think of Harry Vander as well. That was definitely, you know, one of those great musical partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got Lennon McCartney, you know, Jagger Richards, and even on other end of things, you've got people like, you know, Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber and Bacharach and David. Well,
that's
you know, Vander and Young were an unbeatable team, and they had a hit period that ran for a good 20, 25 years.
Harry's house in Sydney will prove that.
That's right. Oh, I'm sure George, I mean, the late George, because I'm sure his family's got some nice little pockets of Sydney real estate. Don't you worry about that.
Yeah, that's right. Jeff, always a pleasure to speak with you. We've spoken before, of course, about the Book of Daniel, which is a great read too. And now this one, Friday in My Mind, the Life and Times of George Young. Mate, it's been a pleasure. We'd urge people to go and have a read of this book because you'll learn a lot about Australian pop history, which I thought I had a fairly good coverage on, but learned a lot through reading your book.
Oh, that's terrific. Thanks very much, Greg. And hopefully, look, if nothing else, I hope it's a good journey too. I think it's a pretty lively ride through, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s and up to the present day because I end the book with John Paul Young on stage not far from where I live here, playing in Thurrul to, you know, a full house, playing Vander and Young songs to, you know, this rapturous response from an audience. And there's John, you know, what, mid-60s now and as fine a voice as ever and really continuing that Vander Young legacy. So it was fantastic to experience that, to be able to actually capture a bit of that spirit in the book as well. So I thought it was a kind of a fitting coda to the book.
Yeah, no, well said. And thanks for being part of the memory and the ongoing salute to Australian music. It's been fantastic.
Nice one, Greg. Thank you again.